Alaska Public Television presents Debate for the State. And now your moderator, Michael Carey.
I'm Michael Carey. Thank you for being with us tonight for Debate for the State. You're watching on Alaska Public Television or KUAC-TV or listening to us on KSKA Anchorage or another public radio station. Tonight, we will hear from the candidates for Congress. We will start with the contested primary races featuring Democrats and Republicans. Afterwards, you will hear from Libertarian candidate who is running unopposed. Joining me on the panel tonight are Lori Townsend, news director for the Alaska Public Radio Network, and Daisha Eaton, South Central reporter for KSKA Radio. Now let's meet the Democrats running for the United States Congress, starting alphabetically with their one-minute opening statements, and we'll go first to Democrat Deborah Chestnut. 1 minute, please, the opening statement.
Hi, I'm Deborah Chestnut. My family drove to Anchorage in 1955. I've been here since before statehood. The job of the representative is to represent all Alaskans all over the state. I have lived and worked all over the state. I've worked as a nurse in Anchorage, Palmer, Nome, Barrow, numerous villages delivering health care, Sitka as a commercial fisherman. So I understand the state very well and the issues involved. And as a representative who is supposed to be the spokesperson for the person on the street, I'm your best choice.
Thank you very much. A one-minute opening statement from Sharon Cisna.
My name is Sharon Cisna, and I came to Alaska 45 years ago. I was a college student at the time. And I lived a very full life, got lots of experience, and ran for and was elected to the legislature 14 years ago. So during the time that I've been in the Alaska State Legislature, I brought the different things I learned, the different skills that took me to that place, getting people together and really working on things differently than a lot of people who have served. But I've been really at the grassroots even as a legislative person. Then a year ago, I had an experience at the airport in Seattle that really changed a lot of things and took me really, physically, to Washington, D.C. to testify. And that really has changed a lot of my life, and it has brought me here.
Thank you, Sharon Cisna. Matt Moore, your one-minute opening statement, please.
Thank you. I'm Matt Moore. I initially came to Alaska in 1987 while I was working for an oil field service company. For 20-plus years, I've been the administrator for medical practice here in Anchorage. And 12 years ago, I began my own consulting business where I teach physicians and their staff how to run their practices more efficiently and how to improve their customer satisfaction. The reason I'm running for Congress is very simple. I would like for my children to have a future here in Alaska. I would like for your family to have opportunities, and I would like for their children to have a future in Alaska as well. We must ensure that our children are well-trained and educated, that they have respect for the resources, and that they develop those resources responsibly in the future. We need a representative who's experienced in business, someone who makes payroll every week, someone who faces the challenges of running a small business every day. Thank you very much. I'll appreciate your vote on August 28th.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Doug Urquidy.
My name is Doug Urquidy, and I am running for United States Congress as Alaska's key to the future. I've been in Alaska for roughly 25 years. I served in the United States Army, First Gulf War. I'm very proud of this state and the military personnel that are here. I'm running because I don't want to happen to Alaska what's happened to the lower 48. We need more jobs, high-paying jobs. We need to start exploiting our resources. As the richest state in the union, there's no reason why there's people going hungry or we have people that are unemployed. I will go to Washington. I will work with the senators that are there, and we will pass bills to get jobs for Alaska. My name is Doug Urquidy, and I ask for your vote on the 28th.
And finally, Frank Vondesar.
I am Frank Bondersar. Thank you for tuning in this evening. I'm pro-jobs, pro-choice, and anti-fascist. My top priorities are restoring open government and ending the fascist culture of corruption where politicians are bought by the highest bidder. Also, ensuring any terrorist or national security threat is neutralized by legitimate and effective means, and restoring the constitutional and civil rights trashed by 30 years of Bush-Reagan fascists. I will do my best to protect Medicare, Social Security, and the Affordable Care Act from attacks by lunatic fringe fascists who voted for the Ryan budget, like Don Young. We must return to a one-person, one-vote system by public financing of political campaigns. Again, I'm Frank Bondersar, candidate for U.S. House, and you can get my website by Googling Bondersar for Congress. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll now have questions from our reporters, Daisha Eden and Lori Townsend. Lori Townsend will go first with a question for Ms. Chestnut. You have 45 seconds to respond, and if other members of the panel wish to comment on the response, we'll allow one of you to jump in for 45 seconds. So take it away, Lori.
Ms. Chestnut, based on your experience as a nurse, what do you think Congress can do to reduce the cost of health care? And if the Affordable Care Act is your answer, how does that help? What will that do?
Well, the Affordable Care Act is going to reduce the cost of medical services. And it's very complicated. I don't have time to really go into it. But one of the ways is by reducing the cost of pharmaceuticals. But as a nurse, too, I am concerned about delivering services to the bush and remote parts of Alaska, and it isn't cheap. And so there's one issue is the Affordable Care Act, and the other issue is how do we deliver services to all Alaskans who are due those services, and that's an issue for me.
Anyone else in the group want to jump in here? Sharon Sisna.
Thank you very much. One of the real tragedies, I think, and certainly I've seen in the Alaska State Legislature, is we've really pulled away from really putting in not the money, but really making sure that we're spending our money wisely and having the preventative and the health protection that we need to have. Follow our Constitution. Our Constitution very clearly states we're supposed to be promoting health. That's what we need to do. We'll save money there, and nationally it fits as well.
Okay, we'll go to Daisha Eden for Sharon Sisna.
Ms. Sisna, beyond the TSA and invasion of privacy issues, which I know you've talked a lot about, what else are your priorities for Alaskans?
Thank you very much, because in the 14 years, it's only been 1 year that I really have been focused on the TSA issue. And really, my issues have always really focused on well-being of Alaskans. I've gone to 70 communities really looking at well-being. And the Legislative Health Caucus we had for 9 years, we've had it for 9 years, I shouldn't say it past tense, but we've really been looking at the well-being issues. And that means everything. That means economics. That means that you have a government that works and that you're really taking care of the people in every way, public safety, all of those issues.
Anyone else in the group wish to comment for 40 seconds, 45 seconds? Okay. Lori, your question for Matt Moore.
Mr. Moore, you've said that you would like responsible development in the Arctic as global warming advances. What does that mean? How would you achieve the two or balance the two?
Well, what I mean when I say that is very simple. Back in the late 80s, I was sitting on a well and logging it. It's called the Belcher Prospect. It was about 15 miles from the demarcation line that separates the United States waters and Canada. You can't really see it when you look down, but it's there. 10 miles offshore. They did a great job at that time of drilling. They were very responsible. No pollution took place. And I think when we look at our Arctic and we see things like global warming, that means that there's going to be opportunities. There may be less ice that will be up there in the future. It may be much easier for us to be able to responsibly develop that. Now, it's still a very delicate environment, very fragile, and so they will have to take extra precautions when they're up there.
Anyone else want to jump in on this particular topic of global warming? Okay. Daisha Eden for Doug Urquidy.
Mr. Urquidy, if elected, what would you do to improve health care for Alaska vets, and could you please be specific?
For the vets, I'm in favor of the Heroes Health Card, and I'll work closely with Senator Mark Begich to get that bill push through and get a card for all the vets, to take the burden off the VA system so that the vets all around the state can go to the nearest provider and get the treatment they need.
Anyone else want to jump in on this? Mr. Vondersaar.
I would just say that I'm sort of disappointed the governor didn't take the federal money to get the exchanges started for the Affordable Care Act. That seems like very short-sightedness.
Okay. And Lori Townsend for Mr. Vondersaar.
Mr. Vondersaar, you've said that you want to ensure that any terrorist or national security threat is neutralized. Do you support the Patriot Act? And if not, what would you do to neutralize these threats? What does that mean?
Well, essentially better intelligence. George Bush was briefed before the 9/11 attacks and basically told the CIA officer briefing him that he'd covered his rear end and that was all he needed to do. Intelligence is the key to protecting the country. The TSA, a lot of the things that we do, we spend a lot of money and get very little results for it. Neutralizing is like with the drones and things like that. If you once you've positively identified who the threat is and you've known that they've taken American lives, then get rid of them.
Anyone else wish to comment on this national security question? Sharon Cisna.
I believe that one of the really serious issues that we have to deal with is our own people. And in Alaska, one of the handicaps we have is that we have not put in the effort to get an educational program that really does help all students meet their own goals. And when you have people that are not able to meet their own dreams, then you have people that can become dangerous. We lead the nation in domestic violence and many kind of assaultive behaviors. And I think as a country as well, we need to be looking at our people, understanding them, giving them services that actually can deter a lot of those behaviors.
Thank you very much. We'll now turn to a segment of the program in which we'll have emailed questions from viewers and a question from the host myself. This is from John Morris, and this is an emailed question. And we'll start here, I should add, with Sharon Cisna. We'll have 45 seconds, then we'll go to Mr. Moore. All of you will have 45 seconds. This is from John Morris. Mr. Morris asks, starting with Sharon Cisna, given climate change is occurring rapidly in Alaska, and a majority of Alaskans believe scientists when they attribute this to human activity, what is your long-term vision for whether society will change in ways to respond to the global warming crisis? What specifically will you do to help?
I think the really critical thing that is happening here in Alaska is, in fact, that the changes are changing the future of Alaska as we speak, and was just there a couple of weeks ago, seeing the ships out and the northern traffic that's going to be there. So it's going to be more than just global warming that's an issue here. It's going to be having countries right there at our doorway when we're not ready. So security actually is one of the really critical things. And security will never happen until we have strong communities. And that's a real critical thing in my mind, is that we have to be paying attention to the people that are right at the boundaries of all of these issues. Be there for them.
Mr. Moore.
Wow. Well, global warming, the first thing that we're going to have to do is we'll have to acknowledge that we actually play a part in it. There are a lot of people that are back in Washington that think it's just a scientific phenomenon at this point in time, and that's not the case. If you look at some of the gases that they've recovered from core samples and glaciers, they can compare the ratios of CO2 to what we produce today, and the amounts, and you can see that, yes, we have had an effect. As a geologist looking at it from a geological time frame, an epoch, let's say, or an era, it's nothing more than just half a heartbeat, so we really can't say one way or another. But as an individual, I know for a fact that we do have an impact on the warming that we are experiencing globally. So that being said, we have to look at what's happening with our villages, whether or not they'll have clean water supplies, whether or not they'll even have permafrost anymore.
Mr. Yukidi.
Global warming is an actual fact. When I moved up here, Whittier really didn't have a lake. That glacier has actually retreated. Now you can actually go on the lake and you can go visit the glacier. So global warming is a reality. We do need to start looking at relocating some of these villages that are close to the shorelines. A few years back, we had a village where they got a storm through there, and it started eroding it really quick, and we had to do emergency response to get those people out of harm's way. There is things that we can do ourselves. Right now, we have to, up on the North Slope, burn off all excess natural gas because it's just too much. That's damaging the environment. That's helping to the global warming. We need to either burn that off cleanly or divert it to something else.
And Mr. Van de Saar.
The first part of solving any problem is actually recognizing the problem. There apparently are no longer too many people that deny that people cause global warming after the hottest summer in the lower 48, droughts and forest fires. The big thing we can do is try to use less damaging things, like with natural gas, go toward natural gas away from coal. And the other thing Alaskans need to do is get ready for people to come up here because we still have water and a fairly decent climate after the lower 48 heats up.
And finally, Ms. Chestnut.
Well, we all agree that there is global warming, and certainly it's affecting Alaska tremendously. And as Doug has said, we've already had to move several villages. So we need to look ahead and plan ahead instead of just having things happen. And that is troublesome to me that we do that. So as a state, we need to look at that, and then on the federal level as well. In Fairbanks, we're already losing our permafrost, which is causing havoc to our building. Houses don't do well once permafrost starts to melt, and we're going to have to look at new building codes, new ways of building. The forest, they're speculating, will change from a taiga forest to a savanna. We're going to look at our animals will change as well. Some will die off, and other new ones will come in. Big changes.
Thank you very much. The next question, we'll start with Mr. Moore and then go on to Mr. Keady. And the question I have for you candidates is, if you become a member of Congress, you'll be in Washington, D.C., making a variety of decisions that deal with federal and national policy. But you're also citizens of Alaska, and you undoubtedly will have opinions on things that go forward in Alaska and take place in Alaska, transpire in Alaska. With that buildup, the question, Mr. Moore, is, are you for or against the Pebble Mine? The proposed Pebble Mine, as I was corrected several times.
Okay, as long as it's proposed. For me, I've looked at some of the information so far, and as a geologist, I will tell you, the last place you want to put a sulfide mine is in an area with high groundwater. That's where the Pebble Mine is. That being said, we still have a permitting process that's in place. We need to go through the permitting, give them an opportunity to see if they can make it work and see if it'll actually fly. Personally, no. It's not going to be a go.
Mr. Keady.
I'm in favor of it. Back 8-9 years ago when they were actually started their initial exploration, I was there. I saw what was going on. If it's managed properly and a proper facility is set up, I do believe it can be done safely. A lot of people don't realize proposed Pebble Mine is above Lake Iliamna, meaning that if something did happen, God forbid, it would have to get across 70 miles of open water and then down a river of 60 miles before it actually hit Cook Inlet. Mother Nature has a way of taking care of problems, but that's beside the point. I believe if they do this here and we go through the permitting process and they get these here set up, they need to set money aside to take care of emergencies such as that. Also money set aside so they can put it back to its natural state when the mine's finished.
Thank you, sir. And now we'll turn to Frank Van de Saar.
If they can do Pebble Mine without seriously destroying the salmon, I would say okay, but I have serious doubts that they can do it without destroying the salmon, so I would say no.
Deborah Chestnut.
No, I'm in for developing our resources, and mining is an important historical part of Alaska, but not on that scale, and I have looked at it as well, and I do not think they can develop the Pebble Mine safely. But I'm not against exploring other ways of developing, extracting that sulfite and the ores there. You could make smaller ones, possibly, but not the way it is being proposed right now. I do not support it.
Sharon Cisna, you have the last comment on this segment.
This issue, for me, is really one that talks to impacts. And the fact that we have an industry coming into Alaska, into a very critical place in terms of the amazing resources in fisheries. And when I've been in that area, it's so awesome to see what happens in that fisheries world. And you're talking about a resource that maybe equals, in terms of immediate the immediate sales price, say, but not for the long term. You don't have a resource in those minerals that is going to last the amount of time that fisheries has. So making positive, and I think going slowly on things like this to make sure that we are making sure that the local community has a chance to do, say, value added or something. And then the other thing I keep on thinking about with this kind of issue, and this is a big one, is the fact that we're not encouraging our local communities to be the people who develop the resources close to them, make them maybe smaller, but really able to help communities earn a great deal and have jobs right where they are. This one just closes that.
Thank you, Sharon Cisna. This question will start with Doug Urquidy. And Mark Lovegreen writes, is the system used to provide, pay for, health care for uninsured individuals in the United States, the way we've done it up to now, is that system adequate? If not, what do you propose to replace it with?
That system isn't adequate. That's why we've been, over all these years, been worrying about this healthcare bill. Obama did come out with a bill. It went through Congress fast, too fast, I think, but it did make it through Congress. It's been upheld by the United States Supreme Court as a valid program. We need to try to give it a chance and see what will happen. I'm really leery about it. I've been spending 3 months reading those documents, and I'm still not all the way through them yet.
Frank Bondesar.
The Affordable Care Act is a good start. As far as all the uninsured things, if I had been able to do it myself, I would have included a single-payer option into the Affordable Care Act, where right now it's sort of been co-opted by the insurance companies to, you know, make more money for the insurance companies. I think if we spent more with a single-payer plan, not spent more, but covered more people and did better with the, like most of the European countries, we could get more coverage for people with less money.
Deborah Chestnut.
The major problem with healthcare are the insurance companies, and people need to understand that the insurance companies are in the business to make money. And in order to make money, they do everything they can not to pay your bills. So we all think they're our friend, but they are not. And I have worked in the healthcare for decades now, and I do know what they do. I've thought all along, ever since I graduated from nursing school, that this was a bad business to have health insurance, period, intermingle with medical care. And then it separates people from their care. It becomes a money issue. The hospitals are in it for the money as well. So I am behind the Affordable Care Act. It needs tweaking. There are issues that I have with it, but it's a good start.
Sharon Cisna?
The problem that we have had in Alaska is a different one, and this is something that I've actually been studying for quite some time. And the state of Alaska did have the opportunity and was slow to take it up to do studies on the uninsured in Alaska. And what they found when they completed their study was that Alaska is very different than other states, and that is we have many more seasonal jobs, part-time jobs. So people are working part of the year covered by insurance and then part of the year uninsured. And we have fewer insurance companies in the state doing business, many more fewer. And so as a result, we're different than other places. This is a conversation that just simply has not really been brought out and discussed among all of the different communities in Alaska. Each one of the 70 I've been to are very different. And we as a state need to create our own very individual solution to this. And I think we do need to work with the federal government and with all the different kinds of health systems we have and come up with a solution.
Thank you very much. Well, now we'll go to our segment of the show, which involves candidates' questions. Oh, Mr. Moore, did we miss you? All right, good.
Just once. It's okay. So fee-for-service right now is what we currently have. And so when we have someone that can't afford insurance or can't pay for their medical bills, typically what we find is they present at the emergency rooms. When they show up at the emergency room, they're not turned away, they're given service. There's EMTALA, that means that we have a certain set of surgeons, we have a certain set of doctors that will be on call and will serve that underserved or that population that cannot pay for it. When I look at what we pay, my business, what I pay for insurance for my employees, about every month, for each premium that I pay for each individual, I pay an extra $100 to help cover that cost shifting. We have physicians that are in our community that will see a lot of people that are in the indigent population. And because of that, when we look at their practices may not be profitable, or in fact, they may not be able to survive for a few more months. If it's spread out a little bit more, it's a little bit easier. The ACA Act, that makes it a little bit more possible for everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. We'll try this again. Now, as we go back to candidates having questions for other candidates, we'll start with you, Ms. Chestnut, with a 15-second question or so. The recipient or question will have 45 seconds to comment, and then you will have 30 seconds to comment on the answer. So pick an opponent, ask a question.
Okay. Sharon, you talk about your caucuses and stuff, but have you ever put through any legislation around it?
Well, thank you. I actually have been working on legislation. I actually just went through legislation from the last 14 years, and every session I've had bills in. And I don't think of us as opponents, actually, because we're all Democrats. And I've spent 14 years in the minority. And so in those 14 years, what I've had is pieces of legislation that I've gotten one hearing for, and then it sits in the next committee. So what I have done as a minority person is constantly partnering with majority members. And I've gotten quite a few pieces of legislation through, some really critical, and dealing with the uninsured, for instance, as one of many subjects. But it's actually working beyond party and actually stopping the partisanship that really does occur by creating relationships with the people around me.
Okay, so I'm still confused because I was really wanting to know what specifically you put forward for healthcare in Alaska. And,
We'll have to take that up later, because that would in effect be a second question, so okay. We'll have to leave it there. Sharon Sisna, your question for one of your opponents.
I don't have opponents. Sorry.
With one of the other people sitting up there, wherever they are.
Okay. Matt Moore is right to my left, and as Democrats, we focus on people and the outcomes for people. And so one of the things that I think is really critical for people who are public servants is the homework we've done as people in getting to know those around us and understanding who it is we wish to serve. Can you tell us some of the work that you've done in understanding the many different kinds of people we have and what kind of service you can give?
Sure. Well, it depends on how far you want me to go back. While I've been campaigning, I've been able to take a tour of the Southeast, and I've met people that are in Ketchikan. I flew over to Metlakatla. I've gone up to Fairbanks, been up to the Mat-Su several times. For me, I've had an opportunity before, because I like to hunt and fish so much, I travel all across the state, and so I get to see people in some of the villages that we talk about that are eroding, Shishmaref, that's on a barrier island, seeing what their problems are. And when I was here in Anchorage, what I get to see is I get to see folks that are in my community council, being on the president for 5 years, being the vice chair for 2 years. It gives you an insight to what your neighbors need and what they're really missing in their lives.
Sharon, Cisna, if you want to respond for 30 seconds to what you heard.
I agree completely with your comments, Matt. And I, too, was a community council president. Mm-hmm. And the 27 years of my business was all over the state, helping small businesses. And then the 70 communities I've spent sometimes a number of days in. So I agree with you. And mm-hmm. that's what I think is a special thing about this group.
Matt Moore, your opportunity to ask a question.
Sure. Well, I'll ask Doug. Doug, you were talking about the Pebble Mine and the potential for runoff and what could happen, and you were talking about it going to a First Lake and then out to the Cook Inlet. Where do you think the damage would occur if we had a lot of water contacting sulfides?
It would damage the environment. Me being a construction worker, I do understand how things are built. We've improved our mining technology dramatically. I haven't actually seen the Pebble Mines proposal because they haven't released it yet. But typically what they do is they'll build a dam, as you know. It's layered with multiple layers of membrane to prevent any leakage. Then they put gravel over the top of that there. And then they also have lines that run through it to recycle it. Mm-hmm. If there is a problem and something happens, they would have to get to Lake Iliamna. First off, the sulfurs are from the soil itself. It's going to get to the lake. We need to have first response set up at all times, so if something that does happen, we can stop it. But we still have 70 miles of open water that is not part of the salmon that we need to be able to address if it happens, mm-hmm. and we should be able to handle it by then.
Okay.
Mr. Moore, you have 30 seconds if you wish to comment on the answer you heard.
Sure. I think, Doug, more than anything else, if we have sulfides that get in contact with water, we're talking about creating sulfuric acid, mm-hmm. and we're talking about lowering the pH, making the water more acidic, and what we're really talking about is stream damage more than anything else. When you have stream damage, if fish are present, it could get to the point where it could screw up their navigation systems. They don't know where to go anymore, or maybe they can hatch and have a good hatch, but can't return to that same river. So for me, that's really where it is. It's right there in the river. That's where the problem begins and ends.
Thank you. Mr. Akiti, your question for someone else on the panel.
I'm going to go with Sharon. I understand your issue with TSA, and it's a big issue, and it's one of the ones that I want to concentrate on. When you came out, you said that you would not fly because of TSA. You've made the comment that you've been going to 70 different villages, and I remember from one of our last debates, you actually said that you just got back earlier that morning, so I'm assuming that you're flying now. But you previously said you would never fly on a jet plane. That being said, how would you represent people in Alaska where you would have to come from Washington to Alaska over a weekend, talk to the people here, and then turn around and get back to Washington in time to vote?
That's interesting because I've gotten that question many times. And actually, in air flight, the way it works is TSA covers airplanes over 50 passengers. So in Alaska, most people who fly areas outside of the major cities, they're smaller planes. And so you fly without TSA coverage. And you're not touched in any unusual ways. You're not exposed to any kind of radiation outside of the normal kinds of things. And what I have found out in my experience is that Alaska is really suffering from real serious travel problems, and that we only have jet flights, and in, we've lost a lot of things that in 67 we had in place to get around the state, this huge state. So I don't have as much of a problem, and I see more people than the average person does that travels.
Mr. Ikeda, you have 30 seconds to comment.
Well, I know for a fact to fly to and from Washington, you're looking at least 10 hours there, 10 hours back on a jet plane. You would have to fly to Washington. You can't be driving back and forth because you can't represent everybody. I've spoken a lot with Senator Mark Baggage. He comes here 3-4 times a month if he can, and he's doing those flights. My concern is that you would not be able to do those.
Okay, thank you. Frank Von Desar, you have the last opportunity to ask a question here.
I'll ask Deborah since no one's asked her a question yet. Don Young, depending on who you listen to, is one of the 10 or 15 most corrupt politicians in Washington, D.C. Alaska has a particularly poor record with the Corrupt Bastards Club and Bill Allen and all the things that have happened in the recent past. In my opinion, public financing of federal campaigns would be a real good idea. What are your thoughts on the matter?
I agree. I think we need to do better campaign reform than we've had in the past. If we look at other countries, the government gives so much money per candidate, and that's all they get, and that's all they can use for their campaign. That's where I think we need to go, because it is a form of corruption, is campaign donations, contributions.
Mr. Von Desar, you have 30 seconds to comment on the answer you heard.
I agree, and what is it? Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely, and I think money is probably worse than power.
Okay, Mr. Von Desar, we're going to stick with you as we start this next round of questions. Thanks. These are questions from the host, yours truly sitting right here. A number of policy experts, politicians, think tank mavens, et cetera, believe we should raise the age of Social Security eligibility. Is this a good idea or not, starting with you? And I should add, you have 45 seconds.
Okay. I think when they started Social Security, the average person keeled over dead at around 55. So a small adjustment phased out over time might be acceptable, but I'd have to study it a little more. My general impression is, we do other things to change the system first, and then if we have to, we increase the eligibility age.
Depending on the keelover factor.
Well, that as well as other things, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Ms. Chestnut.
Well, we contribute to Social Security by working. So in a way, if we can't retire sooner, we're working longer. So it may make up for that gap there, and I think it does. So I'm sort of not sure if I'm really for raising the limit or not. I don't think it'll age limit. I don't think it'll make any difference.
Sharon Sisna.
I believe that it is just a hard truth that we have so many of us, and I just turned 70, so I'm right there, and I am in my 50th year in the workforce full-time, that at age 70, I still have not retired. And I understand I have good health, but many people are growing older, and I think it's reasonable to, as has been mentioned, to slowly advance that age. The other thing that we have not done is good expenditures of our funding in the country or in our state. And if we were more prudent and more creative with our expenditures, I think we can find the funding to do that as a very slow thing.
Matt Moore.
Well, it will be inevitable that we will have to increase the age for where you'll be eligible for Social Security, but right now, people that have made their plans to retire, they've made their contributions over the life of their career, they're counting on, I guess, rules that were in place, things that they expect to be still there when they retire. So if we start that, we would have to start that with the newest batch of people that come in and enter the workforce, the ones that are already in and paid in, and expect those rules to remain unchanged, should not be penalized for it.
Mr. Keeney, you have the final word on this segment.
I'm 47. I've been working since pretty much since I was 10 years old paying Social Security. It is, as my dad told me, when I worked 25 years, I could retire. As it's looking right now, I'm probably not going to be able to retire until pushing 75. I'm a construction worker. I work with my hands. You don't see that many old men out there swinging hammers. I don't believe that if we've been paying Social Security for 30, 40, 50 years, that you should turn around and start changing on these people now. We know that Social Security is going to bankrupt eventually. We need to basically let it flow as it's going to happen. The younger generation, they're given the opportunity now to have their own little plan set up so they can retire in the future. I don't think we should modify anything at this time.
Okay. And now we'll have a round of questions starting, or a question for the panelists starting with Ms. Chestnut. And the question is this. Paul Ryan and a number of members of Congress and have argued that we should convert Medicare from a government-paid directly system into a voucher system. Would you support that change in Medicare?
No, I wouldn't. Voucher systems don't work. They've been tried before, not necessarily in the healthcare industry, but they will not work in healthcare. One of the problems is that it's a condition, human condition, to get sick. Everyone will get sick, and the voucher system won't cover that at all. So we need better coverage than just the voucher.
Thank you. Sharon Sisna.
I believe that we need to be looking at other ways that we can help the health systems, and to be working on that particular system, to me, appears to be the using up of the valuable oxygen, kind of, in a way that if you focus on one area, put all your time in on the area that's working fairly well right now, and don't deal with those areas that we have serious crises in, then you don't ever get to the answer. And I think it's not the direction I would go.
Matt Moore.
A voucher system would not work. We've had gatekeepers in healthcare for the past 15, 20 years. And what we try to do is we try to make sure that your healthcare money is spent appropriately, that there's no duplication in services. And then when you need to have an expert that tells you these are the tests that you need to have run, you know that that is the next course of action that you should take. More than anything else, I believe what we need is we need to be looking at preventive health. We need to be looking at immunizations for children when they're younger, so when they become the age where they can actually benefit from Medicare, they'll be healthier and they will need less resources.
Doug or Keedy?
I'm against it. It's not beneficial to anybody to have a voucher system. It's never worked anywhere else. It would not work here. We need to actually stop taking money out of these programs for the elderly. They have spent their entire life building America, and now we're, as they're, you know, they're hitting their twilight years, we're trying to take the money away from them. No, I'm totally against it.
Okay. And finally, Frank Von Desarm, once again, the question is, would you support converting Medicare into a voucher system?
Would not. The voucher program and pretty much everything else in the Ryan budget operates on what in the military we used to call the kiss-up, kick-down principle, where the poor pay the price and the rich get richer. And I would make the wealthiest pay a fair share of the infrastructure they're using to get wealthy. But the specific question is, no, I don't support vouchers for Medicare.
Okay, now let's turn to our reporters with a number of questions for our panel of candidates. We're going to start with Daisha Eaton.
And this is a question for Mr. Von Desar. You stated that you support the Occupy Wall Street goals. What are those goals, and why do you support them?
Well, essentially, the Occupy Wall Street, while I'm not an expert, but they say that the 99% should be getting, a better deal than the top 1%. Like over the, I don't know, the say 30 years since Reagan took over, the all of the increases in the income have gone to the top 1 or 2%, and the Occupy Wall Street movement says that the people that got bailed out, the big banks and things, should be paying their fair share, and some of them going to jail if appropriate, and that the people with the short end of the stick should be getting a better deal, essentially.
A reminder in this segment, when we have questions from the reporters, other members of the panel are invited to comment on the answer they hear or something else about the question. So is there anybody, one of you wants to comment on Occupy? Yes?
Yes, I would like to. Actually, one of the big issues of the Occupy Wall Street protest was about student loans. And we went from student loans were cheap loans given to actually indiscriminately. I mean, there was no discrimination there, to students by the government. And during the Reagan years, they switched things over to banks. Well, banks are in it to make money again. So then the banks increased the interest rates. They also forced parents to co-sign, no matter what age the student was. And then when the students couldn't meet, defaulted, the parents' homes were actually taken. And so it's a huge problem. It's all about this money. And the students said it's unfair. They're coming out of university owing a tremendous amount of money, and they cannot afford to pay it back.
Thank you. Now let's turn to a question for Lori Townsend.
Mr. Urquidy, you have said that you support increased funding for public projects. What projects would you propose, and how could you get something like this done in a time of such fiscal constraint?
Well, Lower 48 has a vast infrastructure. Every time you need to fly down to Seattle or you go to one of the other big cities, they're doing a lot of bridge work, building roads. Alaska, we don't have those. I don't know if people remember, a couple weeks back, we had an incident with the police early in the morning from the valley, and an individual was pretty much shut down the highway. People from the valley could not make it into work. The highway did not open up until noon. We have thousands of people could not get to work because we don't have a route for these people to get around. We need to have at least multiple ways in and out of towns, villages. So I hate to say it to the Lower 48, we need to take some of that money they've been wasting, bring it to Alaska, and build our infrastructure.
Anyone on the panel want to comment on either the question or the answer? Okay, let's move on to Daisha Eaton.
This is a question for Mr. Moore. Congress has been involved in the war on drugs for decades. Are we winning or losing? Can you explain?
Well, if I was an accountant, I'd say we're losing. We spend a heck of a lot of money, and we still have the same amount of drugs flowing into our country. If we had legalized drugs, I think the prices of drugs would be lower, but is that something I can live with? No, it's not. I can't get to that point, even when I look just at little examples out in the bush in villages where they're either dry or they're wet, the alcoholism problems that they have. And alcohol is one of our drugs that we say is okay, but a lot of people really cannot handle it at all. So when I look at the drugs that we're talking about, we spend a heck of a lot of money, way too much for what the return is. So if we could get to the point where we could say, yes, we'll still have a war on drugs, no, we won't do very much about it, and we won't spend a lot of money, we'd probably be in the same place we are today.
Anyone else on the panel want to comment on the war on drugs? Sharon Cisna.
The war on drugs is a war that is how we're spending time dealing with a culture that really has been losing constitutional rights. And people actually are using drugs and alcohol as kind of an alternate drug to a world that makes no sense anymore. And we've been losing what our country was basically founded on. Constitutional rights is one of them, and many of the different groups that we're seeing form, the many groups, the Tea Party groups, the Occupy groups, all of those are crying that there's something wrong here. My TSA experience is merely a symbol of many of the things that are happening right now. I think one of the ways we deal with drugs, alcohol, make our society make sense. Let's get back to being a constitutional country that really supports that constitution.
Okay, thank you very much, Lori Townsend, for Sharon Cisna.
Ms. Sisna, the problem with lawless activity in rural Alaska is well known and perennial. What do you think the federal government can do, if anything, to improve law enforcement in rural communities? Should Congress work with tribes or with the state?
I think that Congress and state, I think throughout the country, we need to start actually getting attention put on our people and start actually talking with them, not talking down at them. And that's what I've seen going to many of the places in Alaska, right where those things occur. And yet I've talked with those people and find wonderful people who are treated as something different than as constituents. They're not given the respect and the attention that they need to be given. We need to talk to them. These are people many times that have lived here for hundreds, thousands of generations, and they've lived here successfully. We need to learn from them. We need to get their answer to the problems, but we're not really talking with them. We're talking to them. That's what I would say.
Thank you. Mr. Keady.
I believe the federal government should start talking to the villages, the elders. They are the ones that know what's going on. You can learn a lot from them. My Aleut mom teaches me a lot. I understand what a lot of them have go through. And the federal government tends to only want to work with the state. But we're responsible for helping these Native people. And as a congressman, it is my responsibility to help each and every individual. So I believe it's important that we go to each one of these communities and we talk to them and find out what their needs are and get the funding so we can get local people working in law enforcement and helping out through these communities.
Okay, we have one time for one final question from our panel of journalists, and this will be Daisha Eaton for Ms. Chestnut.
Ms. Chestnut, in your statements for your campaign, you've suggested we need to diversify our economy. Can a member of Congress do anything about that? Could you explain?
Actually, this piggybacks on the previous question. Is I think one of the ways to help in the villages is to bring in jobs and create a robust economy. So yes, I've thought about it a lot, having spent a lot of time in the villages, working in the villages. And there are projects. I mean, there is funding through the federal government that would create projects. And one good example is the Road to Nome. And a lot of people were against it, but actually they've started on it this summer already, surveying for it. And they're planning on running the roads from village to village. And that's going to stimulate the economy. It's going to create jobs by people needing to sell, you know, stores. And I think that's one of the ways to help Alaska in general and the remote villages in particular. And that would be a federal funding project.
Okay, anybody else want to comment?
I'll take Greg.
Mr. Moore.
Well, I think she's generally right. I think in a lot of the remote communities where they have the most poverty, where they have the least opportunities for advancement or for any sort of business to take place, those are the ones that we need to be looking at as far as energy, being able to provide cheap energy for those folks. If it's a place where there's geothermal energy, you need to be able to take advantage of that. If it's wind energy, that's great. If it winds up being something that's a blend of those two or basically some sort of a hydro plant, we could do that as well. If we wind up having to do something like transport LNG or natural gas to these places, that's going to be the first step that they can take to actually have some money in their pocket when the winter's over.
Okay, we have time for one more question for our panel. We'll make this for everybody who's up there, starting from Mr. Van der Saar.
Mr. Van der Saar, do you think the federal government or federal dollars should be used to pay for private or charter schools or only public education?
Only public education. If you want to go to a private school, you should find a way to pay for it.
Mr. Keady.
I believe the federal government should pay for public school. It is our obligation.
Okay, Mr. Moore.
Public education. If you want your child to go to a private school, take your wallet out.
Okay. Ms. Sisna.
Private education is something that there's more alternatives possibly in larger communities, but that's for the private sector to deal with. Public should be federal government.
And Ms. Justin?
And I agree with all of the comments. It's our responsibility to provide schooling, but not private schooling.
Okay. I have time for one more question, and that is going to be, we'll start with Mr. Urquidy. Are our gun control laws too harsh, too lenient, or just about right?
Well, they're great if you want to keep guns out of law-abiding citizens' hands. Myself, I'm a gun owner. I love my toys. I go out and shoot as often as I can. And that's probably hard for people to believe, but I am a Democrat still. The gun control is not going to keep guns out of the criminals' hands. I used to be a BTAF dealer way back when, and we used to do all the forms and turn them in. They do background checks, and I think it's getting out of control.
Mr. Moore.
I think we probably have more than enough laws on the books, not only for guns, but for just about everything else. It's a matter of enforcement. When I look at some of the places where there are errors that can occur, when you look at sales at gun shows, where people that are private, they can sell to someone else, that's been acceptable in the past. I think it's still okay. When you look at folks that are selling it on a commercial basis, volume-wise, and representing themselves as being private, I think that they've crossed that line and they are a commercial dealer at that point.
Ms. Cisna, 30 seconds.
The right to bear arms, I believe, is right, but I think we need far more in terms of education.
Ms. Chestnut.
I'm a gun owner, so I'm pro-guns. And I agree that we used to say that when you ban guns, then the only people who have guns are the criminals. And that's true. Now, you know, and the people who are doing all of the killings and the mass killings, they're actually mentally ill. What can we do about mentally ill people? And they obtain their guns illegally anyway.
That's a big topic. Mr. Vondesar, 30 seconds.
I believe that people are entitled to, like, what they used to, the right wing used to call original intent of the Constitution, which is if you want a single shot black powder muzzle loader, you can have that with no restrictions. If you want to have anything more than that, you should be if you have a right to travel, but if you want to you do it in a car, you have to have a license and you have to have it registered. I would say anything other than single shot muzzle loaders should be registered and their owners should be licensed.
Okay, we're going to go to a quick lightning round. That means that I'm going to ask you a question. You have 15 seconds to respond. It doesn't have to be yes or no, but it has to be brief. Ms. Chestnut, you're familiar with the tax pledge that many congressmen have signed, never to raise taxes again as long as they live. Would you sign that pledge?
Absolutely not.
Ms. Cessna?
No.
Mr. Moore?
No.
Mr. Keedy?
No.
Mr. Vondesar?
Hell no.
Okay. Ms. Cisna, we've heard for years about how we're going to open ANWR, and it's our congressional delegation's job to do it. Are you for or against opening ANWR?
I'm against.
Mr. Moore?
For it.
Mr. Keedy?
For it, horizontal drilling.
Okay, Mr. Vondesar?
For it.
And Ms. Chestnut?
We already have the National Petroleum Reserve. No, I'm not for opening ANWR.
Okay. In a few seconds or less, we'll start with you, Ms. Chestnut. Congress is held in low regard by the American people. In surveys, 90% or 80% of the people, it depends on what you ask or who you ask, say that Congress is a pretty terrible place. Why?
Well, it's because of the partisan bickering, and I mean, that's how I see it, and also people are fed up with that.
Ms. Chestnut.
The environment, I think that kind of environment, having been in Juneau with lobbyists around and lots of money to pave the way towards people losing perspective.
Mr. Moore, a few seconds.
Sure. They've lost their ability to communicate. They don't listen to one another, and they've taken opposite positions on everything.
Mr. Urquidy.
Our founding fathers didn't believe that we should have professional politicians. This just goes to show what's going on in Congress right now. People are fed up with it.
Mr. Vondesar.
Money and corruption, Congress basically goes to the highest bidder. The Citizens United ruling is absolutely asinine.
Okay, let's go to our closing statement, starting with Ms. Chestnut. You have 1 minute, please, closing remarks.
Okay. Democrats, I think we can all agree that all of us here are going to work hard for the issues that are important to you. But you need to vote for the one candidate who can beat the incumbent. And that, I believe, is me. And that's because I speak Alaskan. I speak it very well. I speak it better than anyone here. And I could go head-to-head with Don Young on that. In the state of Alaska, Democrats are outnumbered and outgunned. And we always say the reason why we lose this election is because of the money. But I disagree with that. That is not why we lose the elections, because we need to do it differently. And we're just back to the same old, and I'm the one you need to vote for.
Thank you, Ms. Cisna.
What we are missing in Alaska is the voices of Alaska. We need to actually hear from Alaskans across the state in all of the many different kinds of communities that we have. And that is probably one of our biggest problems, is that so many people from so many different parts of Alaska don't understand the challenges that are faced by all those different communities around. And what I've seen is incredible people. We need to listen to them. And government has to do our constitutional job, and that's focus on the people.
Mr. Moore, 1 minute.
Almost everybody knows that we are a resource-based state. We have a window of opportunity to diversify our economy, bring more business and industry to the state, and provide incentives to emerging businesses and create more jobs. We know that the Arctic will be our next last frontier, and it will be extremely challenging to develop. Alaskans are facing challenges right now. We have weak returns of salmon that we suspect are being intercepted in international waters and bycatch from trawlers that are 6 times greater than what the limits are that have been set. We have wintertime fuel prices in Fairbanks that break everyone's budgets and consumes discretionary funds. And healthcare costs are always on everyone's minds. We can't wait much longer. We need to develop hydroelectric projects that will continue to generate low-cost energy for decades, even if the initial project costs are extremely high. As your representative, I'll be working hard every day to achieve this simple but necessary goal. My name is Matt Moore. I would appreciate your vote on August 28th. My website is www.moreforalaska.com.
Mr. Urquidy.
I'm just an average guy. I'm not a professional politician. I haven't been in this chair for 30-plus years. I am a construction worker. I've spent my entire life either in construction or running businesses. I have a bachelor's degree in project management, and I do understand the fundamentals of projects. We need somebody in Washington that actually has normal common sense. I believe Alaska is ready for a moderate Democrat, and as such, I believe I have this opportunity to unseat Don Young for the first time in 40 years, and I ask for your vote. And let's have a nice party on for Don Young's retirement.
And our final candidate, Mr. Frank Vondersaar.
I am Frank Vondersaar. I'm pro-jobs, pro-choice, and anti-fascist. My top priorities are restoring open government and ending the fascist culture of corruption where politicians are bought by the highest bidder, but ensuring any terrorist national security threat is neutralized by legitimate and effective means, and by restoring the constitutional and civil rights trashed by 30 years of Bush-Reagan fascism. I will do my best to protect Medicare, Social Security, and the Affordable Care Act from attacks by lunatic fringe fascists like, well, that voted for the Ryan budget. We must return to a one-person, one-vote system by public financing of political campaigns. Again, I'm Frank Vondersaar. You can get my website by Googling Vondersaar for Congress. That's V-O-N-D-E-R-S-A-A-R. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank Vondersaar. Thank you, Democratic candidates and panelists. Please stay tuned, and we'll meet the Republicans.